The 1995 Sundance Symposium presents session number 320, How Much Diversity Can Mormonism Tolerate? A panel discussion with D. Jeff Burton, Roger Plotho, Larry DePatavis-Stocks, Arthur Bassett, and Armand L. Moss.
In this panel discussion, I'll be the moderator, whatever that means, and incidentally, this is being broadcast on radio station KCPW. We welcome them as well. I'll introduce our distinguished panelists shortly. We're going to be exploring issues of diversity. Unfortunately, the term diversity has come to mean divisiveness to some Mormons, and I'd like to think of us perhaps using the words faithful difference. A faithfully different Mormon is one who, for example, has an unusual but compatible outlook on life, a distinctive way of thinking, or perhaps a different view of history. We've heard that different is good, and different but faithful is very good too, but we need to convince some folks of that. Among church leaders, John K. Carmack of the First Quorum of 70 has written an important book titled Tolerance, which was published in 1993. It's a book that I highly recommend to you. He divides the issue into personal and worldly aspects of diversity, but he does not have a heading for diversity within the church, unfortunately. His main contributions for us as Mormons are to note that acceptance of diversity is an attitude as well as a practice. It must be an active thing, not just a passive thing. And the book concludes with all kinds of limitations. Limitations must, of course, be present for Mormonism to survive as a unique culture. But what we'd like to explore today is, are those limits too narrow? Incidentally, we've seen a few recent examples of efforts to broaden some areas of diversity. For example, the term the inactive, as applied to Mormons who don't attend church regularly, has kind of a negative ring to it. The official wording changed now to less active members, make such members perhaps more acceptable. So how can we encourage additional broadening of the acceptance of diversity? I don't believe we can just demand greater acceptance and expect things to change. I believe we need to identify specific limitations that can be broadened and work on those. We might, for example, work for greater acceptance of the Sunstone Symposium. Let's go on. Our distinguished panelists, and I'm not going to give you their full resume in the interest of time since we only have an hour here. First, we'll hear from Roger Plotho, who is the publisher of The Spectrum in St. George and an accomplished author and theological thinker. Then we'll hear from Laurie DePavita-Stocks, who is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Utah. Then we'll hear from Arthur Bassett, a uniquely gifted writer and author of the Sunstone article, How Much Tolerance Can We Tolerate? And finally, we'll hear from Armand Moss, who is professor of sociology and religious studies at Washington State University. He's also the recent editor of the Journal for the Scientific Study of Religion and also the author of the book The Angel and the Beehive, The Mormon Struggle for Assimilation. Following our panelists, we'll invite you to ask questions or to share your thoughts or experiences. If any of you have brought written statements, I'd appreciate to see. Albert Peck and I have talked about the possibility of having a column, perhaps titled Exploring Diversity, which would look at these diversity issues, and certainly the kinds of things that we can get from you folks would be helpful. So let's begin then with Roger Plotho.
My presence on this panel brings to mind a couple of sports analogies. I hope you won't mind if I start with that. I'm the lone academic failure among these four people, and I'm leading off, which, if you're familiar with baseball, basically means that I'm setting the table for the four power hitters or the three power hitters to follow. Probably more apt would be I'm the fourth of the golf foursome, the high handicapper who they pick up because the real golfer couldn't make it. I also want to give you about 30 seconds of background as to where I come from on this and other theological issues. I'm a fourth-generation Mormon, raised in the Midwest, but moved to Provo when I was 12. And I've spent most of my adult life in small and mid-sized towns in the West as a journalist, the most recent of which is St. George as publisher of the Daily Paper and St. George in Cedar City. And so I come to this issue with the perspective of rural Zion and the people that live there. And I suppose in this audience that makes me a contrarian, and so the title of my remarks is A Contrarian's View of Diversity. And I'd like to address this issue briefly with that in mind. First, I'd like to start by repeating some wonderful words written a few years back by Levina Fielding Anderson in Sunstone. I'm sure many of you are familiar with these. She wrote, I quote, "Recently I stood in a little meadow below our cabin in Lamb's Canyon, up to my waist in green plants. Slowly I rotated in a circle, looking at what was growing within a 3-foot radius. I counted 23 different varieties, none of them trees or shrubs, none of them flowering, all of them a different shade of green. To perceive each of those aspects of green, texture, and shape without being able to name them, describe them, or even remember them accurately was an exhilarating revelation of how highly God values diversity in even little things. God doesn't plant lawns, he plants meadows, but we belong to a church that currently values lawns. Their sameness, their conformity, the ease with which they can all be cut to the same height, watered on schedule, and replaced by new turf if necessary, and against which it is easy to spot dandelions. All organizations are limited in their ability to handle diversity, but our church seems particularly limited right now in its ability to cherish and nurture individuals as individuals, as wild geraniums, catnip, western coneflowers, or yarrow, not as identical blades of grass in a uniformly green lawn." Close quote. The statement resounds with powerful logic. Surely God doesn't bring us together just to make us all the same. Just as surely, the richness of a diversity is something for us to cherish and learn from, not something to be feared and eliminated. But can we really fully embrace diversity without putting our church at grave risk? And when I talk about diversity today, I'm referring to theological, philosophical diversity, not racial or sociological diversity. To paraphrase the title of this panel discussion, how much diversity can any group tolerate before it loses too much of the sense of community and shared values that causes it to be a group to begin with? And who should draw the inevitable lines required to determine at what point dissidents no longer belong in the group with which they are dissenting? One person's intolerance is another's insistence on obedience. Diversity is unsettling and confusing to those accustomed to homogeneity. That's not a reason to run from it, but it's a fact. Most people are drawn to groups because they can be among people with whom they share background and experience and values. Whether formally or informally, someone or something acts as the arbiter to determine how broad or how narrow the standards for group membership will be. When people begin drifting outside those boundaries, is it any wonder that they begin putting at risk their membership in the group? I am sometimes amused at myself and others like me who take umbrage at not being allowed to believe or behave however we darn well please, and yet insist that we remain fully accepted in a group that sets a somewhat more rigid set of rules than we like. This is not limited to religion. I'll use a personal vocational example, a situation as an example. For the first time in my life, I'm working for a large corporation. That association brings with it certain personal financial rewards, and it provides resources to the newspaper that it otherwise wouldn't have. There are also the occasional headaches associated with working with a large company, such as extra paperwork or other types of red tape or bureaucracy, rules. I find this occasionally very frustrating and have been known to complain out loud about it. I do work within company rules, and I do make suggestions on how to improve the process, sometimes to no effort and sometimes successfully. Ultimately, however, I must decide whether to agree to accept both the restrictions and benefits of working within this particular group or move on. We make such cost-benefit analyses in all the relationships we find ourselves in, whether consciously or unconsciously. And while a church is not entirely comparable to a corporation, though the dissimilarities are growing less noticeable, individuals within a church, I believe, face a similar set of options. A church cannot survive in the face of a nonstop theological free-for-all in which there is no identifiable orthodoxy. Someone must set the standard. This is doubly true of a church that professes to be the only one founded and led by Jesus Christ himself through a prophet. A diagram of a simple inductive approach to this conclusion would look something like this. If you accept that Christ restored his church through Joseph Smith, and if you believe that prophetic keys have been passed successfully and successively from Joseph through other prophets to Gordon B. Hinckley, then you must accept as prophetic the pronouncements coming from him and, by extension, those other leaders also set apart as prophets, seers, and revelators. The next logical conclusion is that there's nothing left to discuss. That is how many, indeed millions, perhaps, view the situation. A first-year philosophy student knows the weakness of relying on inductive reasoning without the counterbalance of a deductive test, but that's the discussion for another time. What we have seen during the most recent decades is the evolution of the church's survival instinct, I believe. It has geared itself toward a theology and a set of standards designed to eliminate as much risk to as many members as possible, at the sacrifice of embracing the diversity that many of us yearn for. Perhaps more remarkable than the fact that this has occurred is that it takes some of us by surprise. Is it possible that those who wish the church were more open to opposing views and generally more tolerant of diversity are wanting to eat their cake and have it too? Do we wish to enjoy the associations we develop and the sense of community we feel but are unwilling to play by the rules that come with the associations of that community? I sometimes wonder. President James E. Fowles delivered a marvelous address this summer that I used as the basis for an editorial I wrote for the newspaper. Among President Fowles' remarks was his statement, quote, "Obedience to law is expected in a democracy, and a reasonable discourse is always preferable to contention. Even when the cause is meritorious, if civil disobedience were to be practiced by everyone with a cause, our democracy would unravel and be destroyed. Civil disobedience is an abuse of the political process in a democracy." Close quote. If that is true of the relationship between government and the governed, and I believe it is it any less true of the relationship between a church and its members? At what point does tolerance for diversity become an unacceptable compromise of principle? That clearly depends on one's position on the diversity spectrum. Those comfortably riding the mainstream are less interested in embracing diversity than those caught in the whirlpools near the banks or below the rocks. All that said, and that got you all uneasy, it's an obvious understatement that the church can, clearly, and does need some even-handed tolerance for diversity today. It is possible to reconcile tolerance for diversity with a commitment to standards, but it takes great skill and is bound to be misunderstood, especially by those in the mainstream. Hence, we rarely see it. I deeply admire the handful of church leaders who have successfully negotiated a full embrace of the church while endorsing an inclusive approach to church doctrine and membership. Hugh B. Brown may have been the last of these to rise to prominent status in the church, though the short tenure of President Howard W. Hunter showed the promise of a sincere outreach effort by the institutional church. I hope I'm not betraying any confidence to any confidences, and I don't see Calvin here. When I reminisce about numerous lunchtime conversations I had with Calvin Grondahl when he and I were both employed at the Standard Examiner a few years ago. Calvin has a wonderful insight into the thinking of church leaders who fear that too many church members might be lost if the church were to loosen up too much. Calvin was, and I presume still is, able to be philosophical about the intolerance he saw in the church to the point that he's been able to make a tidy sum of pocket change by poking fun at it. I don't think he's gotten bitter, although I certainly see in him and in myself and in others of us anger. I believe he didn't excuse the intolerance or insistence on obedience, if you will, but he did try to understand it. I have a good friend who has been a bishop now for about 3 years. He has a realistic attitude about the job, including when he was asked to do it, which means when he was asked to be bishop, he was far from pleased. He was horrified. Still, he has gone about his work sincerely, and he has done his best. He's done it his way, much to the frustration of some of his superiors. He has no patience with endless meetings, bureaucracy, and rigidness. We desperately need more bishops like him. Will we get them? I think so. But change is very slow, perhaps a generation too slow. The lay membership, I believe, is far more tolerant than the leadership, beginning at the ward level. The lay membership is certainly far more diverse than the leadership at all levels. And those of you who are here this morning to hear David Knowlton's presentation, I think, would heard the same kind of message there. The point is that a real opening to diversity will have to bubble up from the membership to the leadership rather than the other way around, barring something absolutely unforeseen. Wouldn't it be fun to institute affirmative action within the church? It's been 6 years since Elder Boyd K. Packer delivered his well-known address on a course correction for the church. that emphasized inspiration over programs. The basic message was for leaders to loosen up and allow the members to heed Joseph Smith's admonition to govern themselves. Has anything changed? Not noticeably. Despite the best intentions, we are clearly part of a highly structured organization that rewards conformity first and foremost. I believe the existing diversity of the lay membership of the church will profoundly affect the tolerance exercised by its leadership, though the change of pace is certainly glacial. But a church that is now truly worldwide on certain set of standards can't continue to be governed with a Wasatch Front mindset, and it won't be. We will have more bishops who are more interested in Christian service than towing the line because the membership eventually will demand it. But it takes real courage for a church leader to receive and accept the inspiration required to call bishops who don't fit the current mold. And I've worded that very carefully. Only a recognition that the church rank and file needs and demands a new breed of leader will result in those leaders being given the opportunity to serve. The wait for those with that kind of courage to rise to significant positions of leadership will likely require patience. What we've got to decide is what our role will be in facilitating the evolution and what kind of Mormons we will be in the meantime. The psalmist said, "Be still and know that I am God." As we slog our way through the inevitable changes that we all are destined to experience, we do well to remember that admonition. Thank you.
Good morning. I was so thrilled with Roger's baseball analogy. He certainly credits me with more power than any Mormon woman is used to receiving, and I appreciate that very much. It was joyful. I appreciate the opportunity to be here and to participate in this very important topic. I want to say at the outset that I am not here today to plead for acceptance of diversity, but rather I'm here to argue for the welcoming and embracement of diversity. I don't think diversity is something to be accepted, like we accept the fact that we occasionally get the flu, but I think it's something to be welcomed and embraced and sought after. And also that the shared values we have in the church be based on the love of Christ for each person, rather than on adherence to dogma or on conformity. I think one of the fundamental dilemmas that we face is this. On the one hand, the gospel is based in the truth that Jesus loves each individual enough to have died for each individual on the planet. That each individual, as an individual, is fully and unconditionally and infinitely loved, period. That his sacrifice was not for a group. It was not for this group of people over here, and if you fit in, the sacrifice applies to you. But it was for all of us, for each individual on this planet. That's a little disconcerting. That sort of means that people we don't like and don't accept and can't stand are infinitely loved by the Savior that we worship. That can be a little disconcerting when we think about it. The gospel, then, is inclusive. It includes everyone. In contrast, the church as an organization tends to be exclusive. It includes only a few. We have requirements for membership in the church. We have rules for what is acceptable and what is not. And this is legitimate. It's legitimate for any organization. And I think we can argue that it's necessary for an organization to survive, that it be exclusive to some extent. I think maybe one of the things we're exploring in this panel is what is that extent? Organizations, after all, are inherently contradictory environments. And this is a contradiction that we all live in. Not only is our organization's contradictory environment, but we struggle with the inclusivity of the gospel and the exclusivity of the church. I mean, let's consider this. Suppose we walked into church every Sunday, and when we were handed the program, we were asked, would you prefer smoking or non-smoking? Which section would you like to, you know? And what one could argue that perhaps we should have a smoking section to welcome people who are fighting that battle, or even who don't care to fight that battle. Jesus died for them too. You see, but I'm just pointing that out, is how many of us would be comfortable with that? Well, anyhow, I just want to limit my few minutes to two groups and speak of them in a personal way because they're groups that I have current and recent membership in. One is women in the church, and the other is single people in the church. How much of their diversity can we tolerate? I just want to share an experience that I had last summer when I first met my husband 13 months ago in the Los Angeles Temple. We had we went to the temple, and then he had worked in that temple and loved that temple, worked there for many years. And we had recently met, and I was trying to be nice and friendly, you know, and not be disruptive in any way. But anyway, so as we were, he's kind of turned around and walked down this hallway that had portraits of all the presidents of the church. And he's really into church history, which I haven't been, but anyway. We're going around, his favorite presidents and all these portraits. And I liked that. I thought it was really neat and enjoyed that. And then we went outside and to the parking lot, and he said, over here at the visitor center, they have the miniature statues of the Nauvoo statues to women. Would you like to see them? And I said yes, because I had not seen them. And I went over there and saw the statues, and you've seen them, you know, a single statue and a woman doing this, a woman in prayer, a woman training her children, woman in old age sitting in a rocking chair quilting, you know, this. And all of a sudden, just so much welled up inside of me, and I thought, what would statues to Mormon men look like? What kind of group behaviors would we put in a statue? Of course, it would be nonsense. We don't need statues to Mormon men. They already get enough attention. And then, as I walked through there, I started to cry, and Hugh was saying, "What's wrong?" I said, "Why are women groups in this church? How come only men are individuals? Men are people. They have pictures, they have names, they have quotations, but women are groups. We all do the same thing. We're all the same. We aren't individuals here." And in terms of embracing diversity, one of the diversities that I would argue for embracing is the diversity of Mormon women. That we are not the same. That we stop the assumptions that you meet a husband and wife, and you don't have any idea what his occupation is. He could be anything from an auto mechanic to a rocket scientist. You don't know. But her, you can pretty well guess, homemaker, mother, what her day is like compared to what his day is like. And I think that for those Mormon women who choose to have a diversity of activity, we need to tolerate that. And not even tolerate it, we need to embrace it. One more example from my experience as a stake single co-chair before I was married. I'm going to try to mask time. I can't mask time. It happened last April. But I'm mask place and everything because I don't want to betray a confidence here. One of the women who I respect and admire the most, she was my education counselor when I was Stake Relief Society president several years ago. Has never married. She's very accomplished, serves in the church faithfully. She is Relief Society president now. She's a tenured professor at a local internationally known college. She's raised by her parents to believe that she could do anything, that she was important, that men were not more important than women, that married people were not more important than single people, and so these kind of baggages didn't bother her. She was not raised in that mindset. She was in the temple being trained for a special ward session there, and so she went down early with the ward leaders for special training. And the second day, she said that the temple president would always mention her as the single sister. which sort of unnerved her. But the second day, a member of the presidency called her into his office and said that, pulled out one sheet of paper that had eternal marriage at the top and gave this to her and said, "Sister, whatever, I'm not going to say her name, read this. This is the most important document you will ever read in your life. You need to set your life in order and get yourself married." Now, what is it about this dear sister, that's so intolerable? What is it about her singleness and her service that is so unacceptable? And how she left the temple that she loved feeling so deficient. Let me just leave that. And, of course, another group to add to this are people who are homosexuals, who have a different orientation. What is it about them that is so unacceptable when they offer so much to us? Let me just mention something that I found on email, and then I'll stop crying here. The performer Yanni mentioned, and this is a quote, "A little while back, I was watching an interview with one of the astronauts from the space shuttle, and in this interview, he was describing his experience while he was orbiting the planet. And he was saying how beautiful the Earth looks from above. But he said that much to his surprise, when he was going over Europe, he found that he was having a hard time telling the countries apart from each other, that there were no lines on the ground." He's used to seeing lines on the map, but there were no lines on the ground. "These lines don't really exist. They are made up completely. They are completely made up by people. They perpetuate the illusion that we are different from each other." He concludes, "I think the world would be a much better place if someday we stopped pretending that these lines exist and we concentrated on our similarities rather than our differences." And I would like to plead today that we remove the lines that exist between us. Thank you.
Following Roger's baseball analogy, if I remember my baseball, I'm glad I'm not in fourth position here. I'd hate to see a cleanup batter drop down a bunt. The things I have to say today, I'm going to come at this a little different way. You've got available my thoughts on diversity within the church in the earlier article that I did on how much tolerance can we tolerate. And I always hate that when people quote themselves, but I just mention that as an excuse here as to why I'm going on to other things. I come to you as a church academic dropout, as a person who in his younger years was thoroughly interested in church doctrine, church history, all of those sorts of things. About the time Sunstone was getting started, in fact, I think it was the first of the Sunstone Symposia, I was going through something of a kind of intellectual crisis in my own life, and was coming, as I illustrated in the paper that I presented on knowing, doing, and being, that I think there are terribly important things in the church to address that often we're not addressing. I like to think that perhaps the most profound passage of Scripture for me, anyway, and much of this will be very personal, because I don't know how to respond from my administrator's point of view about diversity. I understand the complexities of the problem. So what I want to do is just to tell you how I've lived with it and hope that it might be of interest to someone. That passage of Scripture comes in the 13th chapter of Corinthians that we all know so well, and is repeated and echoed in the words of Mormon as he writes to Moroni in the last part of the Book of Mormon, where he says exactly the same thing. And I'm amazed that we often miss this so much in the church. Let me just read a couple of passages here. After the tinkling cymbal, Paul goes on to say, though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all of the mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains and have not charity, I'm nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned and have not charity, it profiteth me nothing. And if I read Paul rightly, even though one becomes a martyr for the church, even though one gives everything that one has under the law of consecration for the church, even though one acquires all knowledge in the church, if one has not developed love, one has nothing. Zero, zip, zilch, nothing. So I propose to you that that this is what we're after in the church. Now let me take that idea and bring it back into the context of the church for a minute here. I was troubled as a missionary, like many of the rest of you were who served on missions or who have friends who brought up this to you, when people would say, I don't do anybody any harm. I try and do good to my neighbors. So why do I need a church? And I puzzled over that as a young missionary. I think I'm still puzzling over it in some respects, and have come to the following conclusions. The church is here to teach us doctrine, and that's probably, well, it's absolutely valuable, I think, in an orientation of our own lives. The church is here to give us comfort. The church is here to be a support for us. The church is here to offer us a lot of things. But as I reach the point in life I'm reaching now, I think I've heard most of it before. I have recently been called to be the advisor in the High Priest Quorum, and I say I sympathize with you. I just went through that about a year ago, and how do you say something new in regard to church doctrine unless we're creating new kinds of church doctrine sorts of things? And as I look at the church, I have come to the conclusion now that the church exists to force me into a kind of social life. And I don't mean a specific model. I just mean that it forces me to be with people and gives me an opportunity to learn to love. And a lot of those people in the wards and in the stakes that I'm in, I think often the J. Golden Kimball statement about the brethren when he was accused of having been on the outs with some of them. He said, I want you to know that I love all the brethren. So love all some of them a damn sight more than I do others. And I feel the same way within the context in which I'm placed, and I suspect you are the same as well. That it's very difficult for us often to learn to love. That's that scares me when I come to the realization that that's what I'm here for, and that I'm doing such a poor job in the whole business. We've at home just had some recent problems with our dogs, being a little inconsistent out in our garage, and I think after I get after them, you know, what does that say about love? I had an altercation with my grandson last night, and I think, you know, what does that say about my ability to love? Sometimes I think I'm not doing a very good job of it, and I think that the church offers us this kind of an opportunity by putting us with people who are different from ourselves, and then suggesting that we need to learn to love them as well. I think every time I go to church, and I'm the kind of person that likes to watch people. Nathaniel Hawthorne's children said our father would have liked to have walked around with a cloak of invisibility, and I understand that. I like to watch people. I like to find out lives, and I, in my own professional pursuits, have come to the position that I feel that every person who lives has a story to tell about their experiences and what's happened to them that I wish that I could know. I envy the Savior in this regard, in knowing all of us in that respect, and feel so bad when people think, well, you know, my life's not been anything dramatic or dynamic, and I don't have anything to say. We walk into a church meeting, and we walk into a meeting like this, and you think in terms of the people who are sitting right by your side right now. We'll go away, you'll know a little bit more about me, perhaps, but you will not know anything about them And this is what disturbs me often in the church, is that we have not set up a way by which we can get into the lives of each other and find the life stories there that would enrich our own lives so terribly much. I had the very disconcerting experience about a year ago of having one of the members of a high priest quorum that I was in who passed away. I went back to his funeral, and I learned more about that brother in 5 minutes in the obituary that was given by his grandson than I had in 15 years of sitting by him in that quorum every Sunday. My point is, we are different. And we have so much to learn about each other, and we have not found the conduit to do this yet. I think that home teaching, I bless that program for the lives that it has connected me with. I think in terms of testimony meetings that we could do this kind of thing. I think in terms of sacrament speakers, how we could kind of share our life with other people, but we don't. We stand up and quote Brother X, and we learn very easily and early how to make up a talk out of somebody else's talk, and we don't share lives. I think we need to do that. I think we need to learn to love in that respect, and that to me is the important aspect of the church. We go to try and emulate what the Savior taught us. I had a friend, I'm eager for the next session, not only to be done with this, but for what they have to say about out-of-the-body experiences. I had a friend who went through that about 2 years ago. He was not grounded in LDS theology. In fact, he was pretty much of a non-churchgoer from any denomination. And I was fascinated, as he told me, of his experience, because so many of the points that he mentioned kind of tie in with church doctrine. But the thing that impressed me over and over again was this. All of those people come back talking about the love that Christ manifests for them. I think he understands us in a way that we ought to seek to understand each other. I was just reading in Ephesians this morning. Let me just conclude with this. Paul writes that Christ may dwell in your hearts by faith, that you may, being rooted and grounded in love, may be able to comprehend with all saints what is the breadth and the length and the depth and the height, and to know the love of Christ which passeth knowledge, that ye may be filled with all the fullness of God. I believe that that's at the core of what we're all about in the church. I get upset sometimes with people on both sides of issues who insist on pursuing ends that are causing confusion and trouble in their lives, in the lives of administrators. I have concerns about administrators who feel that they have to exert their particular feelings about things. And I think we all need to go back and read the Apostle John again. New commandment I give unto you, that you love one another as I've loved you, that you also love one another, and by this shall all men know that ye are my disciples. By this all men shall know that you are my disciples, if ye have love one to another.
I truly appreciate all that I've heard in this session this morning, both in substance and in spirit, and I fully endorse it. The question before the panel is, how much diversity can we tolerate, or can we tolerate much diversity, or a question something like that. The short answer to that, in my mind, is yes, we can tolerate all kinds of diversity. In fact, the future of the church depends on it. If we cannot learn to tolerate diversity of all kinds in North America, we will never learn to tolerate it anyplace else. So in that very real sense, I think the future success of the church depends upon an almost unlimited ability to tolerate diversity. So yes, I think we can, I think we must, and ultimately I think we will. Indeed, at the level of abstraction at which we usually discuss the issue of diversity, it's hard to find anybody to disagree with the matter. In fact, as we know in our current society, diversity is something of a buzzword. full of political correctness. Everyone is supposed to get up and genuflect. I guess you get down to genuflect, actually, don't you? When we hear the word. So it's really not a very controversial term at the level of principle or abstraction. The problem is when we come down to certain practical questions about it. So that's my simple answer. But professors are in the business of making simple things complicated. And I think that much of the complication of this issue really comes from looking at practical implications and of much of what we have heard already. It seems to me that the real problem is making a distinction, and I think the first speaker, among others, have alluded to this, making a distinction between that which requires really diversity, not only to be tolerated, but where diversity is really required, on the one hand, and on the other hand, that which in which we cannot and perhaps must not tolerate any diversity. Another way of putting it in my mind is making a distinction between core and periphery. Not now in a geographical sense, but the distinction between core and periphery in our intellectual and social life in the church. Distinctions between, for example, what is basic core minimal doctrine that all Latter-day Saints really must subscribe to in order to think of themselves as Latter-day Saints wherever they live in the world, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the enormously rich doctrinal folklore that spreads around the church. That's a distinction not often made, even among many church leaders, though I think we have the records and the processes to make that distinction much more clearly, at least, than we have so far. In family life, again, what's core LDS and what's periphery? How about a two-career family versus a stay-at-home mom or a stay-at-home dad? What's core and what's periphery in that? You'll get different opinions on questions like that as you go around the church. You'll find some people who think it's downright un-Mormon if you have both parents having careers. I'm not talking here about working wives, quote-unquote, all right? The church is full of working wives. We tolerate that as long as it's to bring in extra income. What we don't tolerate is women's careers, and that's different from working wives. Where is the line between core and periphery on that matter of spousal roles? We're still trying to figure that out. Or on the sheer number of children. If you deliberately limit the number of children that you bring into the world, you know, is that an un-Mormon thing to do? If so, then what's the appropriate Mormon number of children? All these practical questions, you see, we haven't really gotten down to finding a consensus for such things. Or even in politics, not just the difference between Democrat and Republican, and I know you don't have to be a Republican to be a Mormon, but it helps. And But, you know, all kinds of public policy questions. In particular, is there room for people as citizens to endorse a certain kind of public policy for pragmatic civic reasons that in their personal lives they don't subscribe to on something like abortion or homosexuality? Is there room in the church for us to hold to a personal philosophy on the one hand, but for civic reasons embrace maybe a different one in public policy? There are all these kinds of questions. And what I think is our biggest problem is that in each of these levels, in each of these kinds of diversity, the boundary between core and periphery is contested. We don't know where it is. We don't really have any clear idea of where that boundary is. And nobody is telling us. We have to guess. What people get in trouble for. And that seems to be the practical way and the only one so far where we can really find the boundary. So I think what's really bothering us here is this question of contested boundary. If we could find that boundary, then on the one side of the boundary, the periphery side, there could be and there must be room for an almost unlimited amount of diversity that will be acceptable to the church as a whole and to the church leadership. In the core, that's another question. And this ambiguity about that boundary is what I think makes many of us uncomfortable when we have discussions in the church, that is, say, in Sunday school classes, or where we have our discussions at forums like this one here. And incidentally, I must say that when it comes to trying to enforce boundaries and feeling any kind of oppression over that, I have felt far more oppression in trying to deal with this issue at the grassroots than I have ever felt from public statements of church leaders. It's at the grassroots where I most often feel that the saints are trying to enforce a certain mold on this person or that person, and sometimes on me. That's where I feel it. I don't feel it that much from church leaders, though I know a lot of people do, and rightfully so. But in my experience, it's been mostly at the grassroots. We often hear, for example, how contention is of the devil. And that's cited every time somebody has a kind of a provocative opinion. And if the class gets a little too animated, we're reminded that contention is of the devil. Of course, what the Book of Mormon Scripture actually says is that the Spirit, and I read that as having quite a different meaning. I read that as meaning that anger, arrogance, pride, many of those attitudinal qualities that we bring into discussions in the church and into arguments, those things are diabolical because they're so destructive. And I think it's important and instructive to remember that the Scripture does not say contention is of the devil, but the spirit of contention. And we must, I think, strive against that. We find it everywhere. We find it within the church, but I must say that I have heard, I'll put it this way, I have felt that spirit of contention more than once at the Sunstone Symposia. I don't know if any of you had a similar experience, but I sometimes feel that speakers are speaking in anger or with arrogance or with pride, and that distresses me. Of all places, we shouldn't find it here because we are supposedly officially endorsing quite a different philosophy when it comes to discussing contentious issues. So it isn't just under formal church auspices. It isn't just what the leaders do. It's what happens at the grassroots, and by grassroots I include things like Sunstone Symposia. Everywhere, it seems to me, we have to strive against this spirit of contention. But it is complicated by the question of where the boundary is between the core and the periphery each time. And while we can perhaps all agree that we need as much diversity as possible in the periphery, what is harder to agree on, of course, is what is the core. And we don't talk much about that because that sounds a little scary. It sounds a little too much like a mold that we have to construct and everybody has to conform to. But I want to put in a good word before I conclude for maintaining the core, because it is the core, however we are able finally to get that defined, it is the core that gives this religion its substance, its meaning, its significance, and its future. It is the core that gives us as Latter-day Saints our identity. The weaker that boundary around the core, the more fuzzy that boundary around the core, the less meaning it has to be inside of the core. There's a sense in which a religion or any other human community which has no boundaries is a community not worth belonging to. We really do need to have boundaries to give us our identity as individuals, to give the religion its identity and distinction as opposed to or as over against compared to other kinds of communities. And if we don't make this distinction between core and periphery, and if we don't strive to identify and come to some consensus about that core, there is a danger in our search for diversity, we will impinge too much on that core, and we will then lose the identity that we have. We have learned by watching the history of religions, especially in the American experience, that those religions which maintain clear cores, clear boundaries circumscribing those cores, and enforce those boundaries are the religions that thrive and prosper. Ironically, it's not the religions which teach that just anything goes. It's not the religions that try to keep the boundary fuzzy. They don't thrive. They eventually die out. And for practical, understandable reasons, we really do need to identify and maintain that core. And I think that's the struggle that lies before us. And eventually, if the religion is really going to become a worldwide religion and be exported successfully everywhere else, we will need soon to understand what that core is, and then to rejoice in the diversity that occurs outside of that core and brings the wonderful variety to all of us and to our religious life, which we treasure. I certainly hope that we can do that, and I thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. I'm sure we all agree that we've had four home runs here. We would like to now invite questions, comments. We'll have to ask you, though, to come up to this microphone. This is being broadcast, and in order for it to be heard, you'll have to come to the microphone. So, do we have anyone? Yes, sir. And you might address your question specific to a person if you have a question for them or to the panel.
My question is to Armand, and that is, where do you see an excommunicated Mormon's relationship to the core? And I emphasize excommunicated Mormon.
Well, quite obviously, in an organizational sense, that person is outside the core. That's just a practical reality. It's not something in which I particularly rejoice, but I think that's a kind of an obvious statement. But it's also, it seems to me, quite possible, and cases like Levina illustrate it, it's quite possible to be otherwise totally within the core in the things that you testify to, in the way that you live your life, and in all other respects. And of course, that's one of the great tragedies of so many of the recent excommunications, is that they involve people who are put outside of the core on a formal administrative basis, when in every other respect they are clearly within the core. And I think that's that contrast, that illogical juxtaposition, is what brings us all the pain that we feel over that.
I think you have all of you have avoided the basic issue. The basic issue is, what are you going to define as the core? Where is the boundary you're going to say? The articles of faith? Is it the things that you have to answer for the temple interview? Those are the two things. In our ward, for example, if you pay tithing, go on your home teaching, have a temple recommend, and can subscribe to the articles of faith, you would probably be considered core, regardless of whether you're a little bit far out on, and go to Sunstone. You know, I'm still accepted as kind of quasi core. I'm a little kooky in their view, but nonetheless, they accept me. Where would you? And this is addressed to the whole panel. What would you define as inside or outside the core?
Well, you don't
I hope you don't expect to get an answer to that in a panel like this. You're absolutely right. I think we have all avoided that, and for good reason. First of all, that's not an issue to which a pat answer can be given in any acceptable length of time. Second of all, it is not the responsibility of this panel or of this symposium to provide that definition. But we do need to have that responsibility taken and accepted by the leaders of the church who do have that obligation and responsibility. And I hope and pray that they are struggling with this before we try to export the religion much further around the earth. But it has got to be contended with and struggled with. I hope, as I say, I hope it will be, but we can't resolve a question like that. I've got my opinions about what constitutes the core, of course, and you've got yours. But it would be interesting sometime when we have more time, to get into a discussion and see how much these definitions each has will overlap with the other person's definitions. Anybody else?
Did you want to say something there? I would just like to say that I think that the core of the core... And whatever goes beyond that is beyond that, but the core of the core, I would like to propose, be the love of Christ. And beyond that, and I think that fits very well with what Art was saying from Paul's writings. Without that, everything else, the articles of faith, the temple recommend, the tithing, everything else is nothing.
I've got the whole thing figured out. Okay. I mean, I know what the core is. There's no doubt in my mind, although it's different today than it was, you know, a year ago, and it'll be different a year from now. But the question is, you know, who? So what? You know, I don't have any followers, and you have to have followers.
I really enjoyed Sunstone, as I have every year, because, and I'll juxtapose two things you just were talking about. There are lines that we don't see from satellites on Earth, and there are lines that are the boundaries within our church that we don't see to make a core. But there are the people with the callings, and they're sincere people. Usually, sometimes they're people that are reluctant to even have the callings. And so I feel that we have to be individuals and can't ask you, what's the core? Or what should an excommunicated person do about the core opinions and publications? Because I think, as we mentioned, John Carmack has tried to wrangle with tolerance. People do try to wrangle with it who have callings in the church that represent a bigger church than an individual, and they do have the nerve to publish them. Then we can enjoy picking at those things in such a thing as Sunstone and enjoy stimulating ourselves individually, I hope, by doing that. But I know there have been a lot of portions of people's writings that have been picked at in the last 4 days to make a really robust discussion and presentation here. And I appreciate the people that have published and spoken as a core in the church. So we can do that and keep our faith alive. Go ahead, do what you want.
This is a question to Laurie Stocks. I was touched by your story about the lady, the single lady in the temple. My question is it possible not to react to this with anger or emotion, but to simply say to yourself or to the person, you're wrong. I believe you're wrong in substance or wrong in the way you approached me about this thing. Is that one way to deal with that kind of a situation? And perhaps the second question is it possible to have tolerance for that leader who is learning and going through a growth experience and making mistakes in exercising leadership in accordance with the 121st section?
I think you're making an excellent point. I think one of the very important facets of lay leadership training in the church that gets missed is when we as church members are afraid to confront them in a loving way and say, you know, this is very painful for me. For, you know, Would you like for me to stand out on the street corner in downtown New York City and hold up a sign, I'm available for marriage? And, you know, what would you like for me to do to attract a man, you know, and so forth? And so I think that certainly, I think your point is well taken, that that counselor in the temple presidency missed an important opportunity. And I think one of the reasons, though, is that we elevate, the hierarchy elevates or superiorates men over women. And this dear sister, if she had had the experience of having been a stake president or a mission president, maybe she could have stood up to him. But being a lowly woman in the church with no authority, and she was just devastated, and she took him very seriously. She left the temple questioning her own life.
We better make this our last question. Our time is just about up.
I'll just make this a general question to the panel. Every panel member has made the assumption from the beginning that boundaries are necessary in order for an organization to grow and to thrive. Why does the church have to grow and thrive? Could there be alternative goals for the church, such as maybe nurturing?
These aren't mutually exclusive, obviously. Certainly, if we're not nurturing, then we're not doing what the church is really organized to do. On the other hand, if the church doesn't continue to grow, we can't continue to nurture an increasingly large part of the world's population. I think these two things go together. Growth is what the church was organized for in its original mission statement. And I don't think that we're going to escape that.
I think I would also add I get a little concerned about the idea that the church is there to bless me in terms of nurturing. I think sometimes the church becomes a kind of cross that we bear, rightly so, that it is an opportunity for us to grow, and I think we have to see both sides to it. Obviously, if it doesn't nurture, we're going to eventually have a very difficult time in life, but I think there is the other side of it too.
In terms of boundaries, let me say, if there wasn't a distinction between the Baptist and the Mormons, I would not be here. I'd still be a Baptist. There has to be some sort of boundary in order for me to have some identity as a Mormon. And I think that identity issue is not a growth issue, it's a survival issue for the church as an organization.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for joining us for another hour of the Sunstone Symposium. We're coming to you live from Salt Lake Hilton in downtown Salt Lake City at 150 West, 500 South. And we invite those of you in the listening audience who are interested in things that you've heard or things that are coming up later today to join us at the Salt Lake Hilton. There's a charge for each session, but they're reasonably priced. And there are other events that are worth attending, as well as the lectures and panels that we've heard. There is an art auction going on during all of today, and a lot of very generous and talented Mormon and Western artists have donated works that will be on display, and then silent bids will be taken through the day and collected until about 7 o'clock tonight, when the final bids will be made. And we invite any of you out there to join us for that. That's a free event. You can just come down to the Hilton and browse through the pieces of art. Also, coming up at 11:15, which is in our next hour, we will have a screening of Trent Harris's cult classic, or soon-to-be cult classic, Plan 10 from Outer Space. If you're not part of the symposium, there's a small charge to get in, but in addition to the film, which you would be able to see for probably the same price somewhere else, Trent Harris himself will be here answering questions, talking about how he involved Mormons and Mormonism in his film, and how he went about making his film on a relatively low budget. And that again is at 11:15. Also coming up at 11:15, for those of you in the listening audience, a panel will be discussing a book that caused some controversy in the last few years, Betty Eady's Embraced by the Light, a book about near-death experiences. We'll have a panel which will include Lou Mensch, who is a clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Utah, Daryl White, who's a professor of anthropology at Spelman College in Atlanta, Richard Abanez, who's the founder and director of the Religious Information Center and the author of a book called Embraced by the Light and the Bible, and Michael Goodrich, who has had experiences, had near-death experiences herself. That will be beginning in just about 8 minutes or so, and we hope you'll stay tuned for that. There are other events that you might be interested in. A new hymnal that a composer has written will be part of a session introduced at 2:15, and the broadcast during that hour will be a session on Mormons and Presbyterians and how they related to one another in the 19th century. And a popular speaker, Sterling McMurrin, will return at 3:30 p.m., and he'll be joined by William Mulder. Both McMurrin and Mulder were members of a group called the Swearing Elders, which was essentially a Mormon study group that, the abstract of the program reads simply, How a Bunch of Renegade Mormon Professors Raised Hell in the 50s. That'll be worth tuning into, I'm sure. And then the concluding session of the day at 4:45, an interview with a Mormon historian, former BYU professor and former LDS church member, who has since been excommunicated for things that he has written, D. Michael Quinn. There will be an interview with him by Martha Sontag Bradley, who is editor of Dialogue and teaches history at the University of Utah and formerly at BYU. Sunstone is grateful to KCPW and Clay Anderson Audio for helping us with the broadcast of this year's symposium, and especially to Danny Kinimaka, who is the engineer, and taking care of all the small but very important details, and lots of large ones too. Until we join you in about 7 minutes or so, we will return you to the studios of KCPW.